My role as a finance person in early stage startup is not to create a function that's perfect. My role is to create a function that's barely passable so that all the resources that we can actually put towards roles that get money in or get the features out. That is like, this is the reality of startups. And this is a role that you constantly need to have in your head.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to episode 6 of the Good Money Podcast, a show brought to you by Cape. We're a spend management platform helping businesses cut wasteful spending and get control of their cash flow. We bring our listeners up close and personal with world-class financial leaders from some of the most exciting startups and scale-ups who are changing the way we all live, learn, shop, work, eat, and rest. If you join us for the first time, I'm the host of the show. My name's Ryan Edwards Pritchard. And with me today, I'm incredibly fortunate to say, is Alexey Michko, co-founder and CFO of one of the most successful healthcare technology startups in the APAC region in Eucalyptus. We're going to be discussing his experience running the finance function for a number of Australia's most well-known and loved unicorns. Thanks again for joining us, Alexey. How are you doing today?
Pretty well. Pleasure to be here.
Mate, pleasure to be here. I was going to say, we were just talking about your interesting name, your surname. I've possibly butchered it, so I'm sorry. For those that aren't aware, whereabouts are you from?
I'm sure as your listeners will be able to tell by the accent, definitely not from Australia.
Stop it.
I definitely spent the last 15 years here, but originally I'm from Russia. But I left when I was about 13 years old and I went to Switzerland and from there to United States.
Wow. Okay. So you were plucked away from Mother Russia, literally from your teenage years, and then over to Europe and then eventually kind of over to here. I mean, I'm fascinated by Russia just in terms of more the kind of political side, the history, the culture. It's so rich and it's incredibly relevant, obviously, in terms of the power base that's there, Putin, everything that's kind of going on. I'm assuming you still got family over that way?
Yeah, that's right. So all my family is still back in Moscow.
Right. And you managed, I mean, just with the pandemic and everything kind of going on over the last 2 years, have you managed to make it back and forth kind of, well, I'm assuming not. It must have been a couple of years then since you've been back.
Yeah, unfortunately not. It's been probably 2.5 years. In fact, I had a kid and the kid is 2 years old now and my parents haven't seen the child in person, which is very unfortunate. But the borders are opening up, so I'm really looking forward to that time.
Nice, man. Well, what are you thinking? Something for the new year or even maybe Christmas period?
Oh, I don't know. I'm thinking about Easter, probably.
Nice, man. Well, on a positive, Moscow will be starting to thaw from the, minus 10 degree winter at least. We don't quite get the same extremities of the seasons in Sydney in terms of the winters, thank God. But just as some background, we got introed a while back by Nathan Chadwick, who we had on the show for episode 3. I think it was. Nathan's the CFO over at Airtasker. He mentioned you had a super interesting story in how you landed up in the startup space. Where did it all start for you?
So like my dad is also an entrepreneur. So he started his car dealership business in Russia. And then he wanted for the kids to have international education. So he just sent me to Switzerland. That was the thing to do back then. And from there, United States was, I kind of selected it as a place to get my bachelor degree. The only thing I knew is that I was an international student and it sounded like an international business degree was right there in terms of what I wanted to do. So I went over to United States and to George Washington University in Washington, D.C. It was an interesting experience. I got to see Obama inauguration, all that kind of stuff. And then when I graduated, I actually graduated at the height of the financial crisis. So it was like 2009. And I guess for obvious reasons, nobody was hiring, especially a young, fresh graduate with a temporary working rights. But startups were, right? Because they don't pay you in money, they pay you in equity. That's
sweat equity, absolutely.
That's right. That didn't really amount to anything. But one thing I learned through that experience is that actually, if you go into a startup, you get to punch way above your experience level. So for my particular case, I joined the startup employee number 2, and I got to kind of manage other interns on my second week on the job. Right, fresh out of uni, know nothing about basically anything. A lot of red warning signs that startup is probably not the one to be joining, but like I'm oblivious to all these things. But it was a great experience, right? Because you got to kind of make mistakes on somebody else's payroll, which was great, even though they didn't pay me in cash. It was still equity. But that was a great experience. But then I realized that one of the core skill sets that kind of is super relevant in business is accounting and finance. So I've decided to do my accounting degree. I had a good fortune of kind of getting into Sydney Uni and actually doing 2 exchanges in UK and back in St. Petersburg in Russia, which was great as an international student. And then I came into Australia, finished my master's degree in accounting, and the only 2 things I knew was a little bit of startup experience and a little bit of accounting, but nothing practical, right? So it's actually funny that you mentioned Nathan, because we crossed paths in some way very early on in my career, because there were only 2 co-working spaces in Australia at the time, Fishburners and Tankstream Labs. And I actually started my startup career in Tankstream Labs. So I just showed up there one day and kind of asked around if anyone needed a startup and accounting experience. And there was a couple of startups that did. And then eventually I landed at a firm called Interactive Accounting that was a startup firm, a startup accounting firm that was servicing other startups, which was right in my alley, right? Accounting startups, great. And they had a lot of clients in the space, obviously within the Tankstream Labs building, but also, right?
It's a pretty rich space to be in. I think for anybody who doesn't know, I mean, in terms of co-working spaces in Sydney and arguably Australia, but Tankstream Labs and Fishburners, it's kind of one of the hot spots, I guess, where you've got hundreds of startups and founders coming together. It's a real melting pot. So it's a fantastic base if your focus is trying to get into that ecosystem.
Yeah, for sure. There is a lot more co-working spaces now, but back then those were kind of the primary ones for sure. And as I was going through that experience, I got to work on a lot of clients as an external accountant and help them kind of set up their basic accounting processes, right? So anything from like just an accounting record to how to do digital receipts. It was the era when Xero was just
taking hold.
Yeah, getting up. So it was pretty cool. Like cloud accounting was a new thing. we were hip and cool accountants, which was cool. But then I realized that I really wanted to have experience on the client side and actually take ownership of the finance process in its entirety, because as an external accountant, you are paid to do a very specific thing. And even if you see that the process is breaking somewhere else, you actually can't fix it because you have a job and you have time clock and time sheets, so you can't spend too much time on the particular thing. So what I've decided to do is find a startup that wasn't our client and that was kind of promising and cool. So I looked around and I found a startup in Surrey Hills called Canva, and I was employee 28 there. And that was kind of an accelerant to my career because...
Jeez, man, 28 people. When was this? I mean, there must be like feels like there's a bazillion people over there now, but like...
Was 2014, I want to say, something like that. Yeah, it's a while back. But it was great because like... Once again, in startups, you get to punch above your experience level. So when I came in, I was one of the 2 accountants there. And effectively, like the world is yours, right? There are plenty of problems for you to tackle. There is nobody there in terms of your vertical that says, oh, you can't do this. This is too complicated. You just pick up and do. So like one of the things that I kind of cut my teeth on is setting up the Philippines office in terms of like the corporate structure and the accounting side of it. But also something that stayed with me throughout my whole career is setting up employee equity plans, which is one of the core skills if you're in this space. And then after a few years there, obviously Canva was going parabolic. I had an inkling that I wanted to test whether it's actually my skills whether my skills were valuable or whether the Canva was just such a rocket ship that it didn't really matter. So I decided to leave Canva and joined another startup that was also about 20 people at the time. And that startup was Qala, which is, for people in Australia, it's very familiar. For those listeners who are overseas, it's kind of a modeled a little bit after Casper, but takes a little bit more of a digital IKEA kind of route. And that experience was great as well, because I was coming from SaaS, right, and kind of that accounting environment, and now I'm taking a more proactive roles with all the kind of experience that I brought in digital marketing and physical goods space, which is very, very different. So this dual experience is something that kind of stays with me at Eucalyptus now.
Yeah. Question before we go into the Qala piece, because I'm keen to get into Qala because like they are such a recognizable brand over here, an incredible brand, as is Canva globally. But as always, kind of keen to really kind of learn as much as possible in terms of the playbook. ESOPs, you mentioned like that was one of the things that you were quite hot on. And when you went into Canva, I was just curious, just picking up on that part, because there is so much talk and debate with founders and finance teams in terms of how do you get the compensation structure right for when you're an early stage startup, and how do you build something that scale? What's the right balance between equity and salary? And I mean, we joked about it just a second ago, like, you know, where you're a fresh grad. I mean, frankly, this is just being in any startup, but when you're a fresh grad, you know, and it is sweat equity, you know, and there isn't as much in terms of the salary there, and you need to probably get a second or third job or whatever else it might be. When you went into Canva at that particular point in time, you know, was it literally a blank sheet of paper that you had that and just a free license to start actually looking at implementing a ESOP for the first time? And how did you go about that? What was your thinking around it?
Yeah, so in Canva specifically, they already had an ESOP plan in place when I landed there, and I participated in it, fortunately. I guess my input at that stage, it was around the time that Australia was changing the rules around ESOPs and introducing startup concessions. And Canva was also hiring globally. So my role there was to get a hold of the new rules, design a plan that applies to Australians, but also applies for US and our Filipino office. So that was like my role was quite technical. In terms of like staging and understanding how much equity at any particular point needs to be given, that thinking has evolved quite a bit more in Eucalyptus. So that's what we do here. And I've written a guide on the subject. I'm happy to kind of send it to you, and we can maybe append it somewhere in the podcast link as well.
Mate, would love that. Is it a Medium post, blog post?
It's a PDF document that everybody circulates. It has my phone number there too.
Cool. Well, yeah, if we could get our hands on that, that would be fantastic. I don't think there's enough resources out there to help you with tackling some of the trickiest subjects in terms of compensation planning and just building the plan in the first place when you're a startup. My mentor to the team is very much in line with Newton's philosophy, or mindset, I should say, you know, standing on the shoulder of giants. As we might feel that every new circumstance or challenge is super unique to us, the truth is it's always such a well-trodden path. There's all of these other amazing startups and founding teams that have come before us that we have an opportunity to learn from what worked for them, what didn't work for them. And I guess from, you know, your viewpoint, Alexi, when those shoulders are those of Canva and Qala, those massive shoulders, it just gives you such a strong base to make shortcuts to the magic formula that you know actually works. Otherwise, for the rest of us, it's trial and error, right? As you go about implementing these different frameworks, blueprints of remuneration plans and talent strategies into your startup, you'll find you got to total certain things up, such as the base salary, yeah, and then certain things down, such as equity. As you go trapezing through that growth journey of being a startup, a scale-up, or a stay-aheader.
Yeah, for sure. Like on the first point, I definitely think that like startups are about learning, right? So there is, it will never feel easy going through that process, and you will make mistakes, but that's all right, right? As long as you have kind of people you can tap on the shoulder to make sure that you don't make any critical ones. Like in ESOP context, that would be any kind of tax implications that are on you or the employees.
Yeah, well, thankfully, we just saw a huge overhaul of the employee share options plan, ESOPs, from the government last week. That will mean, as a startup and employer, if you're offering shares to staff, they won't be slapped with a large tax bill when they leave. Interestingly, the focus on this was to encourage individuals and startups to actually fly the nest, to leave, and build their own startups. And it's going to cost the government a pretty penny. They predicted these changes to share ownership schemes will cost taxpayers around about $500 million in the budget. But the government's justification around this is that it's all part of a bigger, more systemic issue that they're trying to fix around talent attraction and retention for startups and scale-ups, trying to create some positive churn within the industry. From a CFO and founder perspective, there's no doubt that the best startup employees think and act like owners. And frankly, the best way to encourage them to do so is to make them owners. So as you mentioned, Alexi, you know, ESOPs, essential for any cash-strapped startup that's out there, especially given the struggle to compete with the salaries available at larger scale-ups and stay-aheaders, let alone incumbents in whatever industry you're tackling. I guess, what does it then mean? In terms of how do you use ESOPs? And I'm sure you'll have loads to contribute on this kind of point. I think kind of from what I've seen in terms of bringing share option plans in successfully, education for your team is the key thing to ensuring the scheme is beneficial to everyone. It's articulating what the stock options are all about, especially in Australia, where the equity culture isn't quite as mainstream perhaps as it is in the US or over in Europe just yet, mainly because we've not had the same volume of success stories yet. The reason to flag that, though, to listeners is that if you're offering out ESOPs as an incentive to potential employees or even existing, then the problem exists if it's undervalued as a genuine reward for them if they don't understand it. So hence the need to invest in education within your team, talking about the equity value at your weekly all-hand meetings or at your salary reviews. That's when it really becomes a powerful retention tool. Then it's all about making the knowledge of its mechanics simple as to whether you're using some kind of grading or benchmarking matrix, ensuring this is something that's then reviewed and reset as you go through each of the different fundraising rounds, and then ensuring it's accessible in company-wide documents for everyone. Anyway, not to digress, but some really positive changes coming through for the startup ecosystem last week.
I mean, yeah, the guide that I say is 10 to 20. But in reality, like, it's all to the particular circumstances of the company, right? So if you have two founders and you haven't had a lot of dilution, then sure, 20% sounds reasonable. If you have a particular view on how the equity should be shared, and some founders do, right? Then maybe 20% is reasonable. If you have a very difficult board that comes from some kind of a background that's very against ESOP plans in general, then maybe 10 is all you can get away with. So like, there is no kind of one single thing that fits all the companies, but that's probably the range.
That's such great insight. If you can reward the founding team who's going to be on the journey with you for the next 5 to 10 years, then it's a no-brainer. The first question you should start with then is, who should have a piece of the pie, right? Some founders will, and CFOs should say, will only give options to the founder team. And then others will give them to the whole company as you scale. Then the second question is, how big of an options pool shaped pie does this need to be? Exactly how much equity do you want to set aside for the team? Now, the range is anything, as we said, from, say, 10%. But then for others on the more generous side, as you said, it could be up to 20%. Everyone's scenario is going to be different. You know, it's good to understand what the benchmark of your peers is, though. You know, what are VCs on your cap table saying? What do your mentors and advisors, NEDs or chair, think to it? You know, they'll all have opinions, but ultimately it's the CFO, it's the founding team, you know, alongside the board that must determine the scheme itself. What's important to remember is you've got to budget and spend equity like you would cash that, you know, like cash. It'll change with your growth. At every new round of fundraising, your options pool will refresh, you know, as you set up a new cap table, and there will also be new people to bring in. So budget your options pool as part of the financial planning. You know, for example, when mapping out new jobs, budget in their salaries and stock options at Cape. We've got different bandits of salary and stock options for each of the different roles that we've got planned, for example.
Yeah, for sure. The only thing I would add there, that ESOP pool is a tool, right? It's not the only tool in your set, because like attracting talent, it can be a lot about the story. It can also be a lot about working with motivated and talented people that you have in your team now, and kind of showcasing that could be just as good of a magnet to attracting talent that an ESOP pool would. Retention is a lot about how people enjoy, what kind of work they do here. Do they enjoy it here? So like it's a combination package that you have to look into. And ESOP is kind of like a baseline that you have to have. But it doesn't, I think it's very difficult for you to kind of be above everybody else in the ESOP land, because it's a limited range of things that you can be doing here.
Yeah, I love that kind of viewpoint, that there's a number of different tools you've got at your disposal. Equity is only part of the total compensation. So at the very early stages of a company, you know, the CFO and the team will rely on other things to bring to life the idea. You know, it's only fair and right to give equity to those who are taking early risk, as their work will have a direct impact on the value of the actual company itself. You know, equity lets them gain in the upside. It can genuinely change your life, right? And we've seen that happen time and again, especially, clearly, talking about Canva and Atlassian and these kind of companies. But as you mature and grow, you know, the resources you've got at your disposal changes as well. You know, your offering as an employer means you can over-index on the basic salaries, on bonuses or other benefits, and your ability to attract and retain talent becomes easier and easier as you scale. You know, once you have that momentum and machine set up, it's almost impossible to stop.
Yeah, I think there is a wonderful post on Medium that Mel done about kind of how they Mel and Cliff started Canva. So it's a really, really good read if you have the time. It's quite long, but it's very, very interesting. But what I would say, it felt for me almost like an avalanche, right? Because it starts with a single snowflake, and then it kind of snowballs into bigger, bigger, bigger things. And by the end of it, it's an unstoppable machine that kind of rolls through. And that's probably what we're seeing now globally that Canva is doing. But back then, what I think Mel and Cliff did really well is that they had a success in terms of the first round of investment or a connection that they leveraged into a next success. And that next success in terms of getting the kind of a technical talent gave them legitimacy to do the next thing and attract more talent in. And at the point that when I was there, like majority of our engineers were coming from Atlassian, right? So that definitely a thing where one generation kind of feeds into the next one. And a lot of our engineers are from Atlassian here at Eucalyptus. So I think it's a great flywheel that's definitely starting to happen here.
Man, that's the way to do it in those early days. You got to tap into that flywheel and also leverage your own networks to find people through people, you know, because they will vouch for you. they'll convince other engineers they know to help you about to get you up off the ground. And equally, de-risk the chance of a poor cultural technical fit via recommendations. In those early days, every person you bring in is hugely influential to your success. When you're in your first 10 people, every one person equals 10% output of the company itself. When you start thinking about it that way, it does change your perception in terms of the quality threshold that you then hold up. But looking at this more broadly, we've been talking a lot about the industry and the ecosystem just before in terms of the changes coming through, what the government's proposing on ESOPs. There's a real race happening right now for international talent in the technology sector as a whole and attracting new talent into the ecosystem. As an ecosystem, let alone a wee scrappy startup, what's important as a whole is that we got to retain and reverse any chance of brain drain happening with all those talented individuals that have gone through the ranks of, say, the Atlassians and the Canvas, that they don't flock the nest to North America or Europe. And we need to spawn the next generation of entrepreneurs and operators that join the likes of Eucalyptus, Cape, and others, or build the same. And then equally, they go on and spawn a new wave of investors to support the early stage startup ecosystem. Anyway, out of interest, just on the whole talent sphere front, did you even need to explore offshore options as you scaled? Or did you find that your ability to attract talent here was so strong it was never actually an issue?
Yeah, for sure. Not on the same scale, obviously. But what I found out is that in terms of my personal skill set, things that I took 3-4 weeks to figure out at Canva, in Qual, I could just pick up the phone and call the right person and get it sorted in a day. So there were a massive amount of shortcuts that I could do because I've either faced that problem before or I know people who have done that and I can call upon that resource. So that was super helpful because that means I could concentrate on a lot of things that I haven't done before, especially around physical goods and how you manufacture mattresses and how kind of the digital marketing space works. And I actually met my co-founders there as well, Tim and Charlie. So Tim was heading the marketing team and Charlie was the head of creative. And together we kind of jumped ship and started Eucalyptus. But like that time was very, very beneficial in terms of testing our experiences of things that we thought we knew and now just refining them.
Yeah. Well, I think you said it at the beginning of the conversation, right? Where, and I guess this is the same for anybody, learning on somebody else's book, right? I think you talked about it when, not in the literal sense, because it was sweat equity, but that first role, that first gig you did, gave you the opportunity to kind of get your foot in the door and just start getting some experience, start getting some runs on the board. And I look at career in a very similar way. The most valuable thing by far is always trying to learn and take that on to the next thing. I just, out of interest to drill into that point though, what was it in particular that you found going into Koala that you were able to just close the gap on in terms of the time, the tips, the tricks, that kind of side? I'm just curious, was it more the actual, the day-to-day, because there's two sides just looking into your role. There's the kind of day-to-day running the business, which is more your kind of finance, your payroll, your accounting. Then there's the other side, which is the change in the business, which is dealing with the business model challenges, dealing with the more kind of strategic pieces. So going in there straight away, what was it you were able to implement and kind of benefit from that previous experience?
Yeah, sure. On both sides. So like on the day-to-day, it was super easy for me to go in and say, hey, actually, because I've done HR system implementation in Canva. Actually, we need the same to be done in Koala, right? And I know exactly what buttons to press to make it happen. That's super helpful, right? Because it takes away the time, the wasted time that you do on all of those things and allows you to have the headspace to think about more strategic things. In Koala, for example, in the time that I was there, we launched the Japanese office for Koala. I've never been to Japan, let alone launched an office there, but I've been to Philippines like 10 times in my time with Canva. And all of a sudden, because you have this comparison, you actually know what things to look for, right? Okay, I need lawyers, I need accountants, I need to form banking relationships, I need to do this X, Y. And even on a deeper level, you also start understanding what the archetype of the team needs to be, whether it's finance team or whether it's an HR team. And you kind of refine your mental model as to what sequence do I hire in? Like what experience levels do I need? What kind of personalities work for these particular roles? How do I actually figure out if people are good or not, right? So all these things, you've kind of done it once, you've learned from your mistakes, and you're doing it again, hopefully better this time, and then it kind of the cycle continues.
Yeah, it sounds like muscle memory, right? But on the good or the bad point when it comes to hiring and building out the team, you know, things can go so badly wrong if you get bad cultural fit or someone who isn't hands-on enough for where you're at being a super early stage startup, but still springs a wheel to make it difficult to move them on. You know, time is wasted, progress is lost, you know, and even worse, some of the best people in your team will quit or be close to quitting if you've got someone who's not working out. You know, the advice I was given by mentors was focus on hiring people that will make them a good fit for where you're at over the next 12 to 18 months. Anything shorter than that, and they might not be able to scale with you. You know, anything longer than that, then you've overhired with someone that's a bad fit for the job. And then I guess just kind of focusing on the founding team, you know, you want to try and ensure that you've got in that kind of group functional area expertise. You know, you want to make sure that there's an ability to manage a team in that particular functional area. Ideally, you've got strategic thinkers in the mix as well. You know, the perfect kind of melting pot of it all.
Yeah, for sure. Like, there are a couple points there. One is that it really helps to have co-founders who are specialists in their respective fields, right? So, like, I couldn't imagine doing this without Tim, Benny, Charlie, because they actually know how their respective teams need to look like over periods that we're talking about. Like, I have a very strong understanding of how a finance team needs to look like. I had some inkling about how HR teams needs to get built out. I also, second point there is that my role as a finance person in early stage startup is not to create a function that's perfect. My role is to create a function that's barely passable so that all the resources that we can actually put towards roles that get money in or get the features out. That is like, this is the reality of startups. And this is a role that you constantly need to have in your head. As an example, I was running payroll until 2 months ago, and we are almost 200 people company now.
Wow.
Which like, what should the CFO spend one day a week on running payroll? Probably not. But it's just the sequence in which we've decided to build out our finance team. And that's the point at which, like, we've raised our Series B. Now we have the capability to do that.
And from, I mean, just kind of looking at that then, so 200 people, how big's your finance team right now with Eucalyptus?
So we have 5 people here, and I think we have 2 people, soon to be 3 people in Philippines.
Right, okay. I guess more just the kind of automation perspective. Yeah, it's interesting. One of the kind of hot topics, I guess, when it comes to accounts payable and that side of things, everybody's talking about is more the robotic process automation side of things. Yeah, I think everybody's kind of keen to basically go out there and build some kind of bot, you know, and just kind of trying to find ways that you can take responsibility for automating processes. So is that something that, I mean, you mentioned payroll there as a kind of example, but, and just thinking about your kind of blueprint, how do you look at that in terms of how you go about automating different things within the finance function to allow the business as a whole to flourish?
I think there are two points there. First one is that you need to have the right tool for the right stage, right? If you have two invoices a week coming through, you don't need a bookkeeper. You don't need a fancy tool. You just need to your hands and you type it into the accounting software. That's just the reality of it. But as you progress, the biggest time saving is actually not on the technology side, but it's in the habit forming side, right? During my time in interactive accounting, I've seen far too many startups that don't have a regular accounts payable cycle, right? The founders just pay invoices when they get them. They don't log it through the accounting software. They just go to the bank and pay off the invoice. And then they forget about it. And then it comes in again as a reminder because the other person didn't reconcile it. And then they pay it again. And then they spend time wasting figuring out why they've overpaid 20 grand and who is it for, right? So like all these things on the early stage, like it's just forming proper habits, right? Super important in terms of the timing and in terms of how the process works. Then over time, as volume increases, you introduce things to do the little bit more of heavy lifting of like invoice typing, whatever that might be, or coding in some form or fashion. But then there are other things that start popping up. Like one of the biggest time kind of savers for us was digital cards. So like, I don't necessarily think automation is the golden bullet. I think it's habit forming and then kind of cutting down on wasted time of getting clarity. There are tools there that will allow you to just set up a process in such a way that you don't have to spend that time.
Yeah, I think the utilization. So that, again, to look at both those points, the utilization of tools to reinforce the right type of behaviors, though, so that your finance team and finance function can have confidence kind of using an example here, but providing your staff, your employees with access to company funds so that they can go about doing their job, whether it's virtual or physical cards. You know, ultimately, what you need to ensure is that the expense policy itself, you know, is essentially baked into the card before it's distributed onto the team, you know, so that only approved spending can actually go through. So, you know, the rules and the kind of controls are basically baked in there, whether that's to say card usage can only happen between, I don't know, like Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, it can only happen at certain type of merchants or not certain merchants, right? You might decide that you don't want your team using it at hospitality or for entertainment purposes, right?
Yeah, for sure. I actually have a radically different opinion on this.
Oh, go on then. I'm intrigued.
And the reason why is that I think a lot of people use a template of large corporations and then they apply it into the startup space. And this idea of a budget bugs me a lot. And the reason for that is that budget is a really cool process, but it's meant to kind of reduce unnecessary spending on a very, very large scale. In a startup environment, what it actually does, it creates behaviors where if you're below the budget line, you're safe. If you're above the budget line, you're in trouble. So I will always be below and I will always spend it because if not, I'll lose it, right? This is the thinking, but it's like it's very damaging in the early stage because what you're trying to do is you're trying to make sure that you maximize effectiveness, right? So what we do at Eucalyptus is we say, actually, you don't have a budget, right? So there is no this safe line that you can hide behind. You have access to company cards. It has whatever money there is. You can always request more. And then you have to use your own personal judgment as to whether or not that expense is justified. And then Alexei is sitting on his laptop and has a help in screening those reports and being able to come to you and talk to you about certain expenses. And that actually, what it creates is it creates a culture of thinking around expense and whether this is the most effective way to spend it. And then the second piece around budget that I find quite damaging, especially in kind of a digital marketing environment, is like trying to work towards a budget because like, especially in the digital marketing space, it's a creative process where you make mistakes, right? But if you try to enforce budget, it means you take less risk. And it means that over time, you just have less channels and less messages and less creative assets. You're playing it safe all the time. And then you don't survive because there are other companies that, sure, what, like 1 month, they totally bombed because that campaign that they ran didn't work. But then the next month, they were able to discover a channel through trial and error that works exceptionally well, right? So the idea of rigid rules that the finance imposes on respective teams within the organization, I think it's old school way of doing it. And I think it still has place in larger organizations, but that can't be the default approach at the early stage.
It's a really interesting kind of take on things because, and definitely a challenging take on how we think about things because I think the feedback and what we'd kind of seen to date was control and budgets is a really important theme, especially in this day and age and this kind of environment that we're in and have been in for the last 2 years. You know, people want to cut the cloth accordingly and tighten the belts a little bit and look for access where or tools that provide them with more transparency about what's going on, where every single cent is actually going, and more control around making sure money's being spent responsibly.
I absolutely agree on the transparency point, right? But what happens is if you try to dictate efficiency from the top down, you always incentivize safe from the point of view of like commercial risk-taking behavior. Because like in an early stage, regardless of kind of where you are at any particular point, startups are effectively businesses that if they do things as they do them now, they will fail, right? It's just this idea of reinventing and getting into a better position. And that requires you to take commercial risks in things like digital marketing, in things like product development, all those areas. And then if we try to have this environment where we have budgets, then what we actually focus on is how much people spend on like getting coffees or how much do we spend on office expenses. But like those costs are trivial, right? In the context of salaries, in the context of digital marketing expenses, in the context of the time that you're spending on doing these things. So like I just agree completely with the transparency point. I just disagree with this idea that the clarity of a line is a good thing.
Yeah. So I kind of trying to navigate this part because the thing that's challenging, I guess, is from my background and experience working really closely with various different teams, the way that I'd always looked at it was imagine a bucket. And the way that I'd always kind of, although it's not a hard and fast rule that has to be like this, it's kind of a 70-20-10 type of mix in terms of where do you actually siphon off and bucket, in fact, compartmentalize the resources that you have. And the resources, you know, really high level, two key ones, human capital, financial capital. Yeah, and that 70% really, I mean, to go back to the way that we kind of think about things with a plan is OKRs, quarterly basis. Clearly, if you're pre-product market fit, 3 months, 6 months, however long your OKR cycle is, like frankly, you might not be around in 3 weeks' time. So like you're not going to be going to the same lengths of having these quite rigid OKRs. But if you're post-product market fit, kind of going into seed, series A, series B, you know, where I've seen that kind of blueprint and have firsthand experiences going, well, 70% of my resources, the time and effort, the financial capital that we've got is going to be focused in terms of what we believe the plan is here. And the plan is saying that this is what we're going to try to achieve. This is what we're going to try and ship. This is the number of customers we're going to try and bring through. This is what the funnel looks like. That's what conversion is going to be, yada, yada, yada. And this is what ultimately revenue we're going to be looking to actually achieve, right? The kind of 20 then is the kind of the close bets, the things where there are initiatives that you're working on that might be in part preparing you for the next set of OKRs. They might be a bit more strategic. And then the 10% really is the outside bets. You know, it's the stuff that if you can imagine it on a roulette table that you need to place some chips down because you just don't know if they're going to come in. Now, sometimes that could be product work. Sometimes it could be more strategic partnerships. Sometimes It could be literally building out or looking to build out internationally or through different teams or whatever else it might be. But generally speaking, those are the kind of things from a senior leadership team or CFO, CEO, you know, that's kind of loosely how I kind of try to think about things and then try to make sure that there is enough both human capital, financial capital, first and foremost for that 70% so that we're meeting the objectives just to keep the lights, the hygiene factor, the lights, everything else going. You know, there is then that 20 and 10 mix, and sometimes it's just 30, right? Or sometimes it's 20 and that's it. It kind of varies, but you need to have working on the business and in the business. I mean, we said this about interactive accounting like earlier on, you know, and that kind of variation between those two different things, like it's incredibly important, but you need to have some parameters around that.
Yeah, for sure. And the way we do that is we kind of go through each individual role and define it. Is it essential one or is it growth focused? But one thing I would add is like the beauty of venture capital is that you can actually do both, right? You can contribute enormous amount of resource into the build phase as well as keeping the lights on. So that this is what happens after a fundraising round is closed, right? You have whatever 18-month runway, right? You need to build out the growth team, the extra engineers, the extra product managers, the extra staff to support that as early as you can, right? Because their input into the growth trajectory will be felt 6-12 months later, right? The pieces that kind of keep the current operations going, you kind of grow them linearly in a way.
Yeah. You know what? It's actually really fascinating just talking to you about this in terms of that. I don't know if you've ever read any Duke's Thinking in Bets, but just kind of how you place your resources. We often talk about, I mean, first of all, fantastic book. Anybody that's out there should definitely read it. I think there's a lot, whether it's thinking about building a business or whether it's working in the product space, that is super, super relevant. And the acronym that I always come back to, and we talk about fair bit in the Kate team about, is BOTEX. So the concept of back of the envelope calculations. And it's this kind of idea that really where debates start and finish is all about quantifying, guesstimating, really. If we're going to work on something, like, can we put loosely with a lot of this stuff? Because sometimes it's more art than science. But what is going to be the actual ROI? What's going to be the benefit that we're going to be actually getting back from that initiative? What's going to be the amount of resource it's going to take? How long is it going to take? And the document itself looks a little bit more like a design doc if you've ever looked at them or used them. But it just kind of frames the culture. Or I've found, and maybe this is kind of where I guess some of the kind of culture I've seen and I kind of work on, and probably the kind of culture that you've seen, which is incredibly successful, right? Kind of bringing those kind of things together, because it's building a culture of accountability to individuals to go and think about, well, there's some resource, there's some financial capital, human capital. Right? How can you get as much value from that as possible? And doing the research, come and basically debate the point that this is the direction we should take above and beyond everything else that everybody else is shouting, saying that we should be going doing this, should be going doing that. And it's just trying to get the culture to one where people are thinking a bit more strategically and trying to get numbers to justify the various different projects, because there's a million things that you can do when you're in early stage or kind of a fast growth startup, especially like you guys. So the BOTEX and actually trying to encourage the right type of culture I found has been super useful. But to kind of go back to the just kind of the point on Eucalyptus, because we never quite just finishing that part off. You met, is it Tim and Charlie?
Yeah, that's right.
Tim and Charlie. So you met Tim at Koala. How long were you actually in Koala for before you guys headed off and started with Eucalyptus?
For 2 years we were there.
Okay.
So we all started about the same time.
Right, okay. And how big was Koala when you started? How big was it finished when you guys went off?
Yeah, so when we started, it was about 24, 25 people. So we were like pretty early on. And when we were leaving, they were, I think, pushing 120.
Nice. Okay. So, I mean,
and obviously two offices.
Jeez, man. Okay. So yeah, significant. I mean, man, Japan, that's, do you actually set up an office in Japan?
Yeah, WeWork. It started as a WeWork. I think they have a dedicated office now.
I'm assuming in Tokyo.
Yeah, but also what we've done is that about 10% of our staff in Australia was Japanese in preparation for it, and it actually helped massively. In fact, if you ever try to set up something in Japan, the banking, the online banking system there is atrocious.
Oh, mate, I'm very aware. The infrastructure is aged, it's fair to say. And it's well-known, incredibly difficult place to do business. But I've heard many people, and I think it's a great opportunity for fintechs, but the entry into the market and being able to get, you know, infrastructure players to allow you to go build there is still difficult.
Yeah, I mean, the main banks effectively dominate their little corner of the world. But I actually had one of my staff members who was Japanese sit with me, and I learned every single button in online banking and what it does because they didn't have the English version. So
I was going to say that. So I've only been to Japan once, and this is literally just before the pandemic. And it's a fascinating place. Tokyo is just incredible. I actually went to skiing over in Hakuba, which if you ski or if you're interested, highly, highly recommend. But it is interesting in terms of in comparison to other countries in Asia and how westernized or not westernized. And I think the beauty of Japan is like it is a completely different culture. And yeah, it is fiercely holding on to all of its tradition. I absolutely love that because it feels like just authentic and not like, you know, everywhere else, frankly, that you go in the world and you see a Pret a Manger, a McDonald's, a Starbucks, and H&M.
Yeah, absolutely. They really immaculate, right? And they really take pride in what they do. And it's like shows. And I can definitely respect that.
Nice. Well, anyway, not to digress too much, but you met Tim and Charlie there. You then went off. And then just what was the final trigger, you guys leaving Koala and going, you know what, fuck it, this is it, we're going to press the button, guys, we're going off, we're going to start on this venture? And was it a case of a running start, things were already kind of there, or was it a case of you all just kind of had to quit because you're all working nonstop and actually it's then kind of taking some time out and then starting it?
No, it was definitely from one foot to the next one. In fact, I got married, I guess, around that time. And on my honeymoon, I was setting up eucalyptus's companies to start the thing. So there definitely wasn't any breaks in between. But I think the final trigger for us was like we were building these incredible teams in Koala, right? Kind of world best in terms of digital marketing. But when we were trying to hire people into the business, people would say, well, why would I sell mattresses, right? And then we're like, but it's like Koala is not just like a mattress sales company. It's like a very sophisticated digital marketing operation. And there's like a lot of complex technology that goes into the operational space of it. So for us, we thought that it was a shame that we were doing all these things, but it's so isolated in terms of the vertical that it's in. So we decided to go on and start our own thing with the skill sets that we had. So obviously Tim in digital marketing, Charlie in creative, Benny in kind of business dev, and I am obviously all the operational aspects. And we kind of from those core skills, we have absolutely incredible teams here. And we've met like so many talented individuals who are young, and we gave them the opportunity to build something cool. And I'm constantly amazed at Eucalyptus, what those people can do. And yeah, it's definitely been a cool 3 years.
And then just because, again, kind of drilling into that, so you guys had already, which is normally the case, right? You know, you meet your co-founders from work, you start working on a plan together, and you guys, I mean, you're working on it on your honeymoon. So you clearly went full in to the startup land. And I guess the thing from an outsider, you know, that I found intriguing in terms of what you guys are building is that it's a portfolio more than anything else. It's multiple products, right, under this kind of layer.
Yeah, we should probably start with what eucalyptus actually is.
What is eucalyptus, man?
Is it a plant? Is it a tree? Who knows? No, it's the idea, the original idea was definitely to take like the expertise that we had and allow other startups to link in into our kind of core. And then we would accelerate the growth in those startups that probably had a good product, but didn't really know how to do, set up the operation, the financial things, or the digital marketing part. But in order for us to do that, the first thing that we need to do is like prove that we actually can do the thing, right? So we decided to start our own brand first before we started partnering with other
founders. Yeah, have you come across Founders Factory out of interest back in, over in Europe and the UK?
No, we. I'm not sure. No.
Sorry. The model itself, I mean, it's really interesting because Founders Factory, I think it's Brent Holman.
Oh, yeah. So the idea is there is like startup studio in a way.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. The funny part is that it was the original idea, but it completely shifted when we launched Pilot, our Mental telehealth offering, and then COVID hit almost the same month that we've done it. So it was like absolutely the most luckiest of timings, because all of a sudden telehealth went from like a fringe thing, or is it thing for real, to like, oh my God, this is the thing, right? And we were in perfectly positioned. We had the first brand in the market. We already set up the whole operational teams to be able to support multiple businesses. So we said, well, you know what? We are a telehealth company now, and we have a number of brands in the space. So Pilot for men's health, Keen Fertility for female contraception and fertility space. Then software for dermatology, Juniper actually launched last week for menopause. And we also have a sexual health brand called Normal. And what we've done is we've partnered with outstanding individuals in those fields to come and work with us to build up those brands. So we have a number of kind of founders and GMs for those brands that kind of run their own respective business, and we here support them with whatever the skill sets and the teams that we have. And it actually works beautifully, because some of the businesses, they don't necessarily justify 30 people development team working on it full time, but at certain points in time, they definitely need that resource. And we can very easily shift and provide it across our brand portfolio now.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, because I think the ability for founders to come along and just plug into that engineering talent and depth that you guys have got, and all that amazing knowledge that you've built up from those years over at Interactive Accounting, Canva, Koala, that's invaluable. And then especially just kind of thinking about where Eucalyptus is now, I mean, the time and the shift in terms of everything having to move online. Yeah, I mean, all of a sudden, all forms of health is having to be transformed overnight, right? And again, it's just quite interesting, because the brands that you're building, you know, it's an area in the market where, frankly, we haven't seen relatable brands, I'd say, that kind of normalize a lot of these things. I mean, you mentioned about kind of like men's health. For a lot of the time, it's the kind of stuff that you'd never talk to your mates about or your friends about in terms of what's going on. Same with women's, right? And I think it's only a good thing, the fact that you build in brands around these things, normalizing it, having a conversation, making it super accessible for consumers to then actually participate, you know, on terms that they like, which, you know, privately, digitally. Yeah, I can see why it's been so successful. So congrats.
Thanks. And I should also mention that it's not only Interactive Accounting, Canva, Koala. We have people from McKinsey, we have people from Google, Atlassian, Optiva. Like, I think one of the greatest successes for us was the fact that we could attract a super talented team, and they really made it possible, right? Like, I can't do it without my founders, and we have definitely couldn't have done it without our team.
Nice. Well, my friend, thank you for your time. I just realized, in terms of where we're at, this has been an amazing conversation. I've learned a lot. For anybody that's listening out there, what's the best way for them to get in touch if they've got any questions about anything we've talked about today?
So my LinkedIn, I'm not sure how many requests I'll get, but obviously Alexey Mitko on LinkedIn. Obviously, you can also go to eucalyptus.vc, where you'll see kind of us and our brands, and there are plenty of job openings as well. So do click a button there.
Amazing. Alexey, Thank you so much for taking the time out today. And thank you to everybody who's been listening.
We hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to subscribe so that we can join you again. And if you appreciate the show, please jump over to iTunes and give us some stars. For more tips and notes from the show, check us out at hellocape.com. Talk to you next time. Cheers. Bye.